Hello there, I'm Aaron Martell.
And I'm Lou Figaro.
And welcome to Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews, a podcast where we talk about and review a rock album of our choice. This episode, we are joined by a returning guest co-pilot, Jason Donsis. JD, welcome back to the R4 podcast.
Hey, thanks, Glock. I'm glad to be here. Looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right. So JD picked the album for this episode, and we're going to review REM's 1996 album, New Adventures in Hi-Fi. JD, what's your REM story, and where do you come in with this particular record?
Well, the reality is I'm actually not a very big REM fan at all. And so I grew up listening to a lot of things like hip-hop and R&B type stuff, and it wasn't until the mid-90s when I was a senior in high school, well, maybe a junior in high school, I got a job at a little local restaurant, and the manager there loved alternative rock. He loved like the grunge whole scene, and so he was convinced to change my preferences. So he would every day, you know, he's throwing records in. What about this? You like this? You like this? So 95, which would have been when I was a senior in high school, it was the Monster record that came out. And that was the first time I was like, now I like that. And really started to grow this preference towards sort of big sound, layered guitar, shoegazy type rock. I love the Monster record. I loved bands like Smashing Pumpkins, Oasis, like all of these, you know, 32 guitar tracks over each other songs. Really fell in love with that. So fast forward a little bit, when I got to college in the fall, I was sort of meeting new people. I didn't know anybody there. And I had heard in passing, kind of walking through the dorm, I heard somebody playing this record, and it was Wake Up Bomb that was on. And I stopped and asked, I'm like, is that REM? And they're like, yeah, the new record just came out. So I found it intriguing. I liked the sound of that. It reminded me of that Monster sound. But, you know, when you're a college kid, you're broke and you don't have any money. So it kind of was what it was, until sort of a huge side story of how I was introduced to other pieces of music. But I was going to go to a Black Crowes show in October of 96. That was my love of the time and still is. So I went to this little record store in Ann Arbor to buy the Three Snakes and One Charm CD that came out July of 96. And when I went in to buy the record, this record, The New Adventures in Hi-Fi, was on sale. It was buy one, get one half off. So I thought, well, I like that Wake Up Bomb song I heard, so I'll pick it up. And little did I know at that time when I bought it and started listening to it, that it would basically be the soundtrack of the next 7 years of my life.
Wow.
So I'm excited to talk about it. I'm not, like I said, a huge REM fan, but this record is unique, and can't wait to talk about it.
Okay. Lou?
When I worked as an airbrush artist, I was mentored by this guy named Carl in the Union marketplace in Union, New Jersey. It was like a flea market, and we had an airbrush booth there. Anyway, Carl was a big REM fan, and it was his booth, so usually he got to pick the music. Around that time, I was into like Guns N' Roses and Aerosmith and metal, which he couldn't stand. So we listened to a lot of Morrissey, REM, and later on, I got him actually to like Jane's Addiction. So we played a lot of Jane's Addiction. By the time this record came out, I wasn't working with Carl anymore. So I swore I would never willingly listen to them again until this episode came up.
All right. Well, we covered REM one other time on the podcast for Life's Rich Pageant, and I admitted then that I came really late to the REM party, though I was aware of them as far back as their second album, Reckoning, in 1984. But to me, they were just a college radio band back then. They didn't rock hard enough. They weren't cool. I dismissed them as like a niche act that wouldn't last long. But they certainly stuck around, and as they made their way to the mainstream over the years, I started liking some of their tunes I'd hear on the radio, though I still refused to admit it to anybody. I finally broke down and got Automatic for the People in 1993 because I liked the singles from that album. I couldn't deny it anymore, and bam, they just clicked for me. I suddenly got it. I surrendered. I went and got the entire REM back catalog on CD and ended up becoming a big fan of this band. So when New Adventures in Hi-Fi came out, I was ready. I got it the first week, and that's where we'll start with this episode. Now I'll pass along some basic facts about this record straight from the band's Wikipedia page, so oh well. New Adventures in Hi-Fi is the 10th studio album by American alternative rock band REM, released on September 9th, 1996 on Warner Brothers Records. It was produced by Scott Litt in REM and was recorded in 1995 and 1996 at various locations in the United States. It reached number 2 on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart and is certified platinum by the RIAA. And here's the band's lineup card. We've got Bill Berry on drums, percussion, acoustic guitar, and synthesizer. Peter Buck on guitar, mandolin, bouzouki, bass guitar, e-bow, electric sitar, and banjo. Mike Mills on bass guitar, piano, organ, mellotron, keyboards, and backing vocals. And Michael Stipe on vocals. There are additional musicians which we'll mention as we see fit. And also, all tracks were written by Bill Berry, Peter Buck, Mike Mills, and Michael Stipe. Okay, let's jump into a track-by-track analysis of this album. We start the proceedings with How the West Was Won and Where It Got Us.
There's a flyer out of the line. The story is a sad one.
JD, what do you think?
So this is the most unique song in the album because it's the only one that was completely conceived, written, recorded in the studio. There are other studio tracks on this record, but this one is not anything they did on the road. The story goes that they were in the studio tracking these songs, and in sort of a break, Mike Mills was sitting at the piano and playing this little choppy number. And Peter Buck heard it, started playing a little groove under it, and the tapes were rolling. So they jammed on it a little bit, and within a day, it became this song. It's a song that the band will claim is their favorite song on this record. I think a lot of it is because of just the spontaneity of it and being off the road finally. And it's a song that sets the table for the rest of the record. It's a very unusual song to be an opening song. Especially for me, you know, I came off of listening to Monster and that big sort of fuzzy noise. And the only song I had heard from this record at the time when I bought it was Wake Up Bomb. So I was expecting it basically another record like Monster. And so you put this in, you press play, and you get this little drum groove from Bill Berry right out of the gate. And it's this very smooth, nice little groove, offset by this very jarring piano stabs that give you this feeling of being unsettled. And then, you know, there's little bass notes in there, and all of it's very incoherent. It doesn't seem like it all fits together. And that was very intentional. The song has this back and forth between in the verses being choppy and giving you the sensation of, oh, I feel like it's almost like someone sneaking through the woods and worried about who's going to jump out the bushes. And then it goes into the chorus and it's kind of like, don't worry, this is how it always goes. It's fine. This song has a combination of two things that'll be a trend throughout the album. It's a combination of very specific vocals that make a lot of sense and are powerful. Like when he says the story is a sad one, told many times, it's the story of my life in trying times. Just add water, stir in lime. And then he goes in how the West is one where it got us. It makes you feel like this happens all the time. Don't worry about it. But then it goes into this very tension-filled piece. So for me, it reminds me of when I went to school. Again, this came out September 96. I graduate from high school. I'm off to college. I don't know a single soul. My home life, in all transparency, was not great. And I really wanted to get out of there, but I was scared to death because I didn't know anyone. And so the verse lines give me a sense of that tension of, I want to go, but I don't know where I'm going and I don't know anyone there. My favorite line basically on this whole record is where he says, I didn't wear sunglasses because I thought I might rain. Now I can't see anything. And so it's like you make these little adjustments and it turns out to be worse than you thought. And then I love the point later in that verse, like it's the only time the whole song's pretty monotonal the way he's singing, but then he raises up and he's like, I point my nose to the northern star, and like his voice gets high, and I watch the decline from a hazy distance. And this reminds me of like when I got to school, almost feeling like I'm looking back at home and watching that train wreck happen, but I'm not there. And hallelujah, thank goodness for that. And so I just love the contrast that happens, the solo in it with the piano fill. I've heard Mike Mills say like he intentionally played that as if some random dude were to come in off the street and play it, and they did it in one take. And it's intentionally not melodic. And I just love all of the concept that's in it, plus the groove that flows through it under. It's the strangest opening song I think you'll ever hear, but I love it.
Lou.
Yeah, it starts sounding out like a Chris Isaac tune almost, with that really thick reverb. It's like they're in a wet cave almost. And I see they use the same snare sound as Lars chose later on for Saint Anger. That volleyball to the face kind of boom, you know, during a dodgeball match. So far, it's a groovy, slow burner. Then after the verse, Stipe hits that note that makes me make the same face that Chuck Berry made when Yoko Ono started singing and he and John Lennon were jamming the Memphis, Tennessee on the Mike Douglas show. The problem is, you know, he keeps repeating it. Sha-na-na-na-na. It's so far, he's cementing his place as one of the most annoying frontmen to me in rock history.
So this is REM's road album, with most of the tracks recorded at various venues during the Monster Tour in 1995. But after the tour was over, the band headed into Bad Animal Studio in Seattle to record four additional tracks. And this is one of those. JD explained all that already. Bill Berry opens this with his percolating beat. And unusually for REM, Peter Buck plays the bass line that starts and stops while adding a melodic presence that gives the track a sly, slinky groove. Mike Mills adds that percussive piano part that also starts and stops, so it leaves tons of open spaces in the verses. While the choruses are denser, with Buck's guitar, mandolin, and bouzouki blended together in a blur of string sound. There's a synthesizer line that runs throughout the track that's high-pitched and kind of annoying. It almost sounds like your ears are constantly ringing. And of course, Michael Stipe is here. His voice is very subdued, barely above a whisper, but it works in this context as the lyrics are somewhat obtuse, but that's nothing new for Stipe. But I'm getting that this is about a guy who's fucked up his life, made many mistakes, even had a run of bad luck, and he's trying to find the will to carry on. But it's difficult as he looks around him and all he sees is a bleak future. The story is a sad one told many times. The backing vocals from Mills, along with his discordant piano solo that JD talked about, it adds to the sullen atmosphere, and it opens the record on a gloomy but interesting note. It is very different, very odd. This was the fourth and final single from the album that did not chart. The next track is The Wake Up Bomb. I get high on my attitude, latitude 1973. Lou, what do you think?
Okay, this is a little better. It's the four-chord rock vamp that sounds a little less pretentious than most of this band's output lately. I like the Hammond organ in the background. It gives me a gritty Pigpen from the Dead sound. It's got a bit more distortion, or dare I say, a Ray Manzarek kind of feel to it. This one's tolerable. I wonder what it would have sounded like without an absolute uninteresting twat repeating himself. I'm singing lead.
JD.
All right. So this is my reaction to the first song. So when I think of this song, again, I show up in college. I don't know anybody. I'm kind of nervous about that. My family's just falling apart back at home. So I decide, you know what? I'm here. I'm free. I don't have any rules. There's nobody telling me what my curfew is. There's no one telling me I can't go to the dance or whatever. And so I'm getting after it. And so when he's, singing like, "My head's on fire with high esteem, I get drunk and sing along with Queen, practice my T-Rex moves and make the scene, carry my dead board, been there, done that, anything." I just picture myself, I'm in college, I have no rules, I've never had that before, I just went after it. And the sound overall of the song is similar to Monster, but less fuzz, a little more controlled. I like the groove. This is another song that I can frequently air guitar to. I like the backing vocals and the organs that come into it. So this is an example of REM on the road, because not only do you have the core group, but then you have some other, you know, touring instrumentalists like Nate December and Scott. These guys fill out the sound. And so when they are capturing these recordings, whether it's in soundcheck or on live, there's a much bigger sound to it than normal. It's not overdubs, it's actually played live. Most of the vocals I understand are overdubbed, and I think that's a lot of the reason why some of these vocals are, well, Michael Stipe's pretty gibberish anyway, but a lot of these are fill vocals that he's in soundcheck while they're recording these tunes. You know, he's just coming up with whatever he can think of, and they're sounds that sound good together. Like when he says, "Yeah, anatomic, supersonic, what a joke, I'm done, see ya, don't want to be a lunch meat, pond scum." Not exactly coherent vocals there, but they work in the song because it's just this song about like being sort of nuts. And I just really, it reminds me again of that freedom of being with no restrictions. It's loud. It's raucous. It should have been a single. It was not. But it's a good song. I like it.
The bedrock of this track was recorded on November 16th, 1995 at the North Charleston Coliseum in Charleston, South Carolina. And like JD said, it sounds very much like a track from the previous Monster album. It's a blast of noisy guitar riffs, courtesy of Buck and touring second guitarist Nathan December. Barry's thumping drums and tambourine percussion, and Mills doing double duty on bass and organ. I dig the cadence in Stipe's shouted vocals as he sings, "I look good," or "I get high." It doesn't even matter what the rest of the actual words are. It just sounds cool. But these lyrics are kind of cool, too. To me, it's about a guy looking back at his younger self, that confident, preening young prick who thinks he's too cool for school and full of piss and vinegar. He's older now. He's woken up from those wild and carefree days. He's done it all and seen it all, and he's had enough. That old shit is boring to him now. He's not that guy anymore. I get strong autobiographical vibes from this, but I'm sure Stipe would deny that if you asked him. I dig this. It infuses the record with some energy, which was kind of needed at this point. The following track is New Test Leper. JD, how about this?
Yeah, so building off the point you just made, you know, you're going to get a lot of back and forth on this record between, you know, some of slow, dirgy, introspective stuff and then high energy stuff. So we're coming off the high energy wake up bomb. Like you said at the end of your statement, you know, you go through this whole thing of I'm going to be this wild and crazy dude and get after it. And now I'm over it. And you move into a song like this. Now, musically, I love several things about it. First, I've seen the raw track where they recorded the bass of this. This is another studio track that they played. But in the studio, they play it live. So it's, you know, Michael Stipe standing in the middle of the room with a microphone while all around him you have people playing their instruments. So the shaker that's happening, Barry's on the shaker and Mills is on the organ and Peter Buck is playing the acoustic. And then it's like they do the whole thing again and fill out the sound. So the actual drums that kick in there are later. There's a, while it's an acoustic based song, there's this sort of noisy fuzz guitar behind it through the whole thing that they put in there later. And the song is about being on a talk show. But for me, again, relating to this personally, this is right about the time. This reminds me of the time that I met who would now be my wife. And if I were to make a list of all the things a girl would be and have and their characteristics and the things that they believe in, that I would say this girl would be someone I would never, ever date. She had every single one of them. And I think the same the other way around. And so, like, it's interesting because the title is New Test Leper. And a leper specifically is somebody, like, from biblical. He uses a lot of religious imagery in these songs, starting with this one, and there's others. But in the Bible, a leper is somebody who had this skin disease that was so contagious, like basically they were not allowed to be anywhere. And if anyone come close to them, they had to like announce that they were a leper because no one could come near them. They were ostracized to the fullest beyond anything, you know, anybody else has been. And so when I met my wife, it was kind of like we were both lepers to each other. Like there was no way she could ever bring me home. I had my ears pierced and I smoked and I drank and I did drugs. And she was a conservative little Christian girl, you know, whose family was very stern about that. And so this reminds me a lot of times where when we met and we started dating, we would sit and talk and debate. And so like how this song opens, I can't say that I love Jesus. That would be a hollow claim. To me, that's like brings me back to like sitting and having these conversations and these debates going back and forth. And where I would see, like, I could absolutely see the value in the message, but I didn't believe in everything that was behind it. And this song, while it is, you know, there's some talk show references to it, to me it just brings me back to those early debates with my now wife. I love the musicality. The bass line in this is what drives it. The bass in it is phenomenal. How he walks up and down, he's got these little fills. It really drives the song. And I love the noisy, just a slight noisy fill of the guitars behind it, behind that acoustic groove. It's a song that gets stuck in my head all the time. I love the backing vocals during the verse when he's singing the Call Me a Leper. You know, Mills on this record in many places, background vocal. He's got to be one of the best background vocal guys in any band ever. I love what he does to fill this out. And then I love how it ends, comes to an end, and it's got some sustained notes, and it kind of leads right into the next song. So it's a very good, catchy little jangly tune. I like it.
Lou.
Smelly cat, what are they feeding you? Smelly cat, it's not your fault. I can't get past that now. As deep as he tries to make it, I can't get past smelly cat. I'm sorry.
That's it?
Seriously, that's all he's got.
Yes. That's funny. Recorded in March 1996 at Bad Animal Studio. Buck strums in on both acoustic and electric guitar in the classic jangly REM style. Mills adds typically melodic bass, and Barry holds it down and keeps the song 6/8 time. There are cool ascending organ flourishes in the chorus, and Stipe again sings in a hushed tone, much like How the West Was Won. The lyrics are written from the perspective of someone Stipe saw on a talk show. The guest was mocked by the audience for his unusual, ugly appearance, apparently, and the talk show host didn't really care what the guest had to say. He had his index cards to ask his questions from, and the narrator feels like a sideshow freak, like the Elephant Man, the movie from which Stipe quotes, "I am not an animal." This song generated a little mild controversy with that opening line. JD said, "I can't say that I love Jesus." But to me, this is the most classic REM sounding song on the record, and it's a good one. I dig it. The next track is Undertow.
But this is not my dream, sister. It is cold in heaven. I'm not sprouting wings.
Lou, your thoughts?
It almost starts out like he's doing a Maynard from Tool, and I get all excited. But alas, it's not, and he's not. And I would kind of rather it be Prison Sex than this. The actual act, not the Tool song. Anyway, he's just whining about drowning. They all sound like horny cats on it, sitting on a fence and howling at night. This is boring as fuck. You know, he sounds to me like your little sister's oddly pretentious boyfriend that she brings home from college to a holiday dinner where he just lectures everybody about veganism and how cruel and horrible the meat industry is. And, you know, all you want to do is just take him outside and pants him, kick his ass.
JD.
Well, I'm going to swing the pendulum in the entirely opposite direction of that. So musically, the song with the bass line that opens up, you know, you start with this little bass groove, the noise and the feedback and the little accents on the end of that. I really like, again, I mentioned I'm a fan of sort of shoegaze, noisy stuff. And this gives me all of that. The opening riff is... I wish it would be a little more intense. I wish they would hit it harder, but it's fine. It's good. I can air guitar to it just fine. So for me though, this is all based lyrically. And it's an important song for me because this is a turning point. This is coming off of, you know, I'm the wake up bomb guy. I'm getting after it. I have, you know, fully dove into the lifestyle of drinking and drugs and all that sort of thing. I'm in college. I've met this girl who I just can't get my head wrapped around why I would ever date her. But she's got some pretty reasonable points of how I should be doing some things differently. Meanwhile, I'm failing out of school. I'm not doing very well in terms of academics. And anybody who tries to tell me otherwise, I just don't really want to listen to. And so when you unpack these lyrics, he talks about, I know what I wanted. I know how I wanted this to be. And I just love, like, right after that, the whole band kicks in. He talks about going down to the water. The lyric that's, this is not my dream, sister. It is cold in heaven, and I'm not sprouting wings. This reminds me again of when, you know, my now wife, then my girlfriend, is kind of trying to convince me, like, you need to change. You need to do something different. And I wasn't hearing it. I didn't want any part of it. All of this sounds like a huge justification. I can't say I'm fearful. I can't say I'm not afraid. I'm not a resisting, I can see. But then right after that, I don't need heaven. I don't need religion. I'm in the place where I need to be. It's just full of pushback, this angst between what should I do? I like what I'm doing. I'm having a ton of fun, but it's killing me. And here's somebody telling me I should do something different, and I don't want to do that because then I have to give up all this stuff that I think is cool. He puts a reference to birds in here, which I found really interesting because the bird contrast. And in the lyric, he says, brother, can you see these birds? They don't look to heaven. They don't need religion. They can see. And he talks about they go down to the water. They drink the water. They fly out of the water. Interestingly, in the Bible, there's a reference to birds too, where it says the birds don't worry about what they're going to eat and they don't store up because essentially they know where their food's coming from. They have faith. So there's this contrast, there's this tension there between you know, are the birds just carefree, like they don't need it, or do they just know it's real? And I find that very interesting, and I'm sure he did that intentionally. I've seen some documentaries where Michael Stipe says, I'm not a follower of the scriptures, but he pulls from them a lot, which is very interesting. And then again, for me, the end of it, you know, when he says, I'm breathing water, you know, a body's got to breathe. There's three different contexts there that I latch onto. One is the very specifically literal context of, I'm in a situation where I'm literally probably killing myself, but I think it's great, and I think that's what everybody needs to do, and it's not working. There's the religious context of, I need to move to a different belief system. I need to start to grapple to something more real than what I'm trying to get to. And then there's this idea, it reminds me a lot of my kids even now. So I have basically four teenagers, and I can just picture them, you know, like drowning, like breathing water, right? And I go, hey, you shouldn't breathe water. And they're gonna be like, Dad, duh, I gotta breathe. And they don't ever wrap their head around, like, maybe not with your face in the water. So all in all, with the tension that's in this song, the choice that has to be made, it just brings me back to that time in my life. Again, backing vocals, phenomenal. The guitar figure at the end, so at the outro, the guitar figure reminds me almost like a timer. So like he's presented this argument of, if you live this way, you're going to breathe water and basically drown. You need to live this other way, but he doesn't want to. And it's almost like that end figure, that coda coming out, is like a timer. Like it's like counting down, and it slows down, and it slows down, and it slows down till it's just noise. Almost like, if you haven't made the choice by now, you're done. It's one of my favorite songs. I love that song.
This was mostly recorded on October 3rd, 1995, at the Fleet Center, now known as TD Garden, in Boston, Massachusetts. The bass line of this tune vaguely resembles the Joy Division song Atrocity Exhibition, and actually I hear a Joy Division influence in general, with the crunchy guitars and the pessimistic vocals and lyrics, though Stipe certainly doesn't sound anything like Ian Curtis. There's a hissing sound that pervades throughout the song, and I'm not sure if it's guitar feedback or amplifier noise, but it sounds like a radio dial being turned and they can't find the fucking station. Lyrically, it seems like our boy's having a rough go of it again. He feels like his time is near the end. He feels like he's drowning and no god or religion can save him. Guy's got to take care of himself. He's got to breathe the water instead of drowning in it. Embrace what lies ahead. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. This is not one of the stronger tracks for me, but I still like it.
I also forgot to note, of all the songs, because this is talked about being recorded on the road, this is one of the only songs you can actually hear the crowd at the
yes,
end.
Yes, when it ends, yep.
Yep.
The following track is Ebo the Letter.
I don't get it. I wrap my hand in plastic to try to look through it. Maybelline eyes and girls, boy moves can take you far. The star thing, I don't get it.
JD, what do you say?
So this is a really eerie, haunting song, you know, built around this Ebo, which is a guitar device that makes the guitar sound more like strings. It's smooth. There's a choppy bass line that the smooth kind of Ebo guitar sound goes over it, with a kind of raw acoustic groove underneath that. The spoken word lyrics are a little unusual, but, you know, this is Michael Stipe we're talking about, so I guess unusual is pretty normal. This is Patti Smith on the verse, or on the chorus vocals. It's a hero of Michael Stipe. He reached out to her after she experienced some pain and with some death in her life, and they ended up connecting. The second verse is closer to singing, but then in the third verse, it goes back to the spoken word. The backing vocals are very, they're melodic, but they're creepy at the same time. It gives this very anxious vibe. I love the bass line and the groove that's under it all that keeps it going. lyrically, what stands out for me in this one is, again, right about this time, just sort of pressure and stress really started to kick in. By this time, I'm junior, senior in college. I started getting pretty severe migraines. And when he says the line, aluminum tastes like fear, adrenaline pulls us near. What's interesting is whenever I'm going to get a migraine, the taste in my mouth is as if I'm sucking on like aluminum foil or like paper clips or something like that. So I always could relate to that phrase because it made me feel like anytime I tasted that taste in my mouth, I knew this headache was coming. So I could always relate to that. It's a very soulful song, slow. They picked this as the first single. I think that, well, I mean, the record sold like 7 million copies, so I guess it didn't doom the record, but not exactly a great choice for a first single in terms of getting this record out into the public. But I really love it. It's melodic, and it's soulful, eerie, all of those things. But it's a good song. I like it.
Lou.
I hear the Ebo in the intro, in the riff. Woo! It's there. It's got Bowie influences, that rapish kind of babble verse delivery. Sort of reminds me of All the Young Dudes. Call me crazy. I'm hearing Riot from the Dead Kennedys in it, too. And in nowhere near as cool as that tune. It's slowed way down, but I hear it there. Tomorrow you're homeless. Tonight it's a blast. Patti Smith sounds like she wandered into the studio high as fuck, and they just put a set of cans on her and threw her into the booth with Michael. I can't get Gilda Radner out of my as Candy Slice out of my head. You know, give me, lips so thick. Are you woman? Are you man? I'm your biggest fucked up fan. Rock me. Roam it till I'm sick.
So this is the third track recorded entirely at Bad Animal Studio. It's mid-tempo and very moody due to Buck using the Ebo on his guitar, producing those eerie wails you hear all over this song. There's folky acoustic guitar underneath, Mills on bass, organ, and a mellotron imitating staccato violin strings, and Buck on electric sitar. That sounds a lot like a banjo, at least that's what I thought it was at first. But if you listen close, you can hear that exotic eastern twang of the sitar. All of this densely layered music creates a melancholy atmosphere. And Stipe's vocals are rhythmic spoken word. Not quite rapping, but not quite singing either. He's done this kind of thing before in songs like Country Feedback from Out of Time. I actually like his delivery on this. I read that the lyrics are about a letter Bill Berry wrote to actor-musician River Phoenix, who died of an overdose in 1993 at just 23 years old and was a friend of the band's. The words are full of evocative imagery, bemoaning the price of fame and the toll it takes on you. Stipe says he doesn't get it, and later he references the drug problems that Phoenix would succumb to, smoke it, drink it, here comes the flood, anything to thin the blood. These corrosives do their magic slowly and sweet. And of course, in the chorus, we hear Patti Smith, the godmother of punk, whom I have never been a fan of. But she's a critic's darling, and I tried. I bought Horses years ago, but I just could never get into it. She just doesn't do it for me. Even if I get it, I understand the respect she commands. But in this track, she croaks, "I'll take you over there." And I hear her as like the evil queen from Snow White, tempting the victim with drugs. She's sinister and seductive. "I'll take you over." This track works. It's haunting and sorrowful. And it was the first single from the album that reached number 49 in the Billboard Hot 100, but number 2 on the U.S. Billboard Alternative Airplay chart. Yippee.
Is that?
Exactly. The next track is Leave. Lou, what do you say?
This song has what sounds like one of those old Magnus organs. You remember the ones that you could buy in the mall?
Mm-hmm.
You usually got one for Christmas. The whole family got one for Christmas back in the 70s with those songbooks that they kept in the bench.
Yep.
For the intro. But then it breaks.
Brittle and plastic and.
Yeah. and yeah, they always had the cords on the side too, so you could go to different modes that nobody ever used. Anyway, then it breaks into something completely different. A little Jack White sounding, if you ask me. That's probably where he got it from. If they did more like this, I'd listen to them more. It's really not anything like anything else that I've heard from him. I like it. It really could have been communicated in about 4 minutes, though, and not seven. Does anyone hear, I got the brains, you got the looks, let's make lots of money in it? I forget the name of that song.
Is that the Pet Shop Boys?
I think so.
Yeah. I don't know. JD.
Yeah, so as Lou said, the acoustic sort of organ, Casio keyboard, whatever that opening thing is, comes in and you think it's going to be another ballad, which would be unusual because they don't typically to this point put two similar songs next to each other. But it's not. After a minute of that, we kick in, you got the groove, and then the siren goes off and it goes through the whole song. This wow, 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 wow. And again, you got this contrast between what feels like this urgent siren, like I got to get out of here. It's a fire alarm. There's a tornado, whatever it may be. But the groove under it is so like slow and smooth, and it creates this tension in the contrast. And the groove really sounds very similar to the opening track. You know, almost could be the same little drum groove that is being played there. And then the lyrically, you know, we kick in again, lots of noise, lots of distortion that's behind it, but the vocal is very smooth. It's very kind of groovy and monotonal. And it's like singing about this things that we have to do and being safe while also needing to move on while this urgent like siren keeps going, like I gotta go. I like the crunchy riff overall. I like the, again, we got Ebo that's making that sort of smooth, stringy guitar sound. You know, for me, this was the case where now I'm to the point where coming out of the Undertow piece and the weirdness of Ebo and feeling like I got to get out of here. For me personally, this was time to go. This song spoke to me. It reminded me of that urgency of like, I'm done here. It's time to go home. I need to go. And there's a lyric that's, you know, you got to leave it. You got to believe it. You got to leave it all behind. And it's time to go. The best part of the song is towards the end. Now, so if the 4 minute mark, all like sort of the band cuts out, quiets way down, and it starts to build back slowly at 4:26. The noise comes all back in at 4:30. You get the backing vocals. This is another song that has phenomenal backing vocals from Mills. And then you're full in at 4:47, back into the chorus. That's where they should have ended it. Like at 5:30, they cut into a whole nother verse, which is in my book, completely unnecessary. That's where it stretched too long. The best part, though, of the whole song is when you get into the coda at 6:37, and you can hear the difference between the production value. So very likely up until that point, there's some studio, you know, overdubs and stuff like that. But then after they kind of end the song and you got the bass line and there's a bunch of noise and then it kicks back into the groove to finish the song, that sounds very live. And that's my favorite part. Like, that's what it sounds like from the stage. And it's very cool. This is a staple live song. They play all the time. They still play it now. Really good rocker song that's a little different than anything they had done before that. Just a little too long, in my opinion.
Leave, mostly recorded in November 1995 at a sound check at the Omni Theater in Atlanta, Georgia. This is my favorite track on the album. Or it would be if it wasn't for this wee 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 synthesizer noise that sounds like a fucking car alarm going off and is highly present the entire fucking song, and it drives me batshit crazy. And it's really too bad, because the song is yet another moody bastard that features a cool Ebo melody line, Barry playing acoustic guitar in the intro and then working the hi-hat with the beat that gives the tune a nervous pulse, and Buck's guitar sounding like an angry bear coming out of hibernation. Stipe's vocals are pensive in the verses, and in the choruses he hits some really nasally high notes that really grab me. Leave it! I love that shit. This is one of his better moments on the record for me. Lyrically, our narrator's gotta go, and he's sick of an ugly and sweet world gone mad, whether he just means to leave a bad situation he's in or leave more permanently, I can't be sure. But there is an ominous vibe to the track that cuts to the bone, and this would be one of my very favorite all-time REM tracks if they would just fucking shut that car alarm off, assholes!
It's great.
The following track is Departure.
Just arrived Singapore, San Sebastian, Spain, 26-hour trip, Salt Lake City, come in, spring over the salt flats of hailstone, brought you back to me. Salt Lake City, come in, spring over the salt flats of hailstone, brought you back to me.
JD, your thoughts?
Well, it's time to leave, so I guess we got to have a departure. This is a very monster-sounding song. I like the opening riff. I like the little pick slide into the groove. A lot of distortion. This is a Mills backing vocal clinic on this song. But we're back to spoken word, where it works sort of in the weirdness of Ebo the Letter. This is a little different. It's high energy. I don't even know all the places he says, but he's going a lot of places. He's going here. He's going there. He's going this place. He's seen that place. This carries me, brings me back to where, like, when it was time to go, I graduated from college. I'm leaving. I'm going home. The excitement of coming back home is kind of pushed through this song. I did not go to any of the places he states in the song. I went to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Not nearly as exciting. But the energy and the excitement was there. Backing vocals, again, are the best part. The bridge with the Mills vocals in there. And that overarching riff that's through the whole thing with that monster-style noise and the distortion. And he says, there's so much to tell you, so little time. He's excited to get back home. The energy of the song is great. It's a weird song. I don't really like the spoken word lyrics, but I love the choruses and the overall sound of the song. So I don't skip it. I let it play. It's not my favorite, but I like it.
Lou.
Distorted rocker. There was a Star Trek Next Gen episode that had Beverly, the doctor, hearing this blunder of voices that turned out to be the whole crew all freaking out at once. Before Frasier, of all people, ran into them and blew them up and sending them back in time to get run into again and again and blown up over and over. That's what this song reminds me of. A distorted jumble of guitar, bass, and moanings and yellings from our favorite edgelord. Just too much dirt on this to even hang on to anything. It's the only thing that comes to mind is forced distortion. Forced badassery, like Sons of Anarchy in the first season. It sounds like they wanted to out Neil Young Pearl Jam, but they weren't rocker enough to fucking pull it off, and it came off sounding like Revenge of the Nerds.
Mostly recorded in June 1995 at the Palace of Auburn Hills in Auburn Hills, Michigan. This one's a straightforward rocker, with Buck in December playing the blaring riffs, Mills doubling on the fuzz bass and supplying background organ, and Barry bashing through the heavy beat. Stipe sounds like he's shouting through a megaphone giving public service announcements. Name-checking cities like Singapore, San Sebastian, Spain, and Salt Lake City. It seems to be from the perspective of someone missing a friend who's passed away. Maybe the guy from the previous track, but who the fuck knows? It's Michael Stipe. It could be about nothing, and he's just stringing words together. It can read like that, too. Sometimes I like it when this band just rocks out. They do it surprisingly well, and I dig the shit out of this one. I probably like it better than both of you. The next track is Bittersweet Me.
I don't know you are anymore, but soon I'd chew my leg off, then get trapped in the sun. How easy you think of all this, it's bittersweet me. I can't taste it.
Lou, start us off.
Well, this one doesn't annoy me as much as the last one. I like the contrast of the super clean in the verses getting dirtier in the pre-chorus to the all-out buzzsaw distortion in the choruses. It's got a good midsection that brings us back to the original arpeggiated riff. And as usual with REM tunes, it repeats itself too often and should end way earlier than it does.
JD.
Well, I like how it starts out with that arpeggiated kind of guitar figure. There's acoustic accents to it. This sounds like basically a bridge between old REM and the Monster era REM. It's got, you know, staples of both in there. This is an interesting song because it was recorded at Soundcheck, but it has never been played live. So this song exists strictly through that sound check. I'm sure they did some studio work on it, but overall the guitar figure is the best part about it. I love the distorted. It's got more fabulous, you know, Mills backing vocals that are in here. There's some Ebo that shows up in the bridge. That's very nice. For me, my personal connection to this song, again, I'm coming off, you know, leave where I had to get out of there. I had to leave from college, get back home. I departed. I got back home. And you know what? It wasn't everything I thought it was going to be. And I was confused by that. I thought that maybe things were going to be, all of my dreams were going to come true, but that's not how I originally perceived it. And so the lyrics really hit me when he says, I don't know who you're living for. I don't know you at all anymore. I actually ended up breaking up with who is now my wife, my girlfriend at the time. Just a lot of confusion. This reminds me of that. I'd rather chew my leg off than be trapped in this. How easy you think all of this is bittersweet me. Lines like, I don't know what I'm hungry for. I don't know what I want anymore. It speaks to confusion. It speaks to not really knowing exactly what I'm searching for. But all in all, you know, this is one of the better. This is, starts a string to come up where there's a lot of samey sounding songs, and this is the best of them. So this is one of the highest rated songs, I would say, on this record for me, just because it speaks to that tension of being back home and trying to figure out now what, now who am I going to be? Tastes of old REM, tastes of monsterish REM. I like the hybrid between the two. It's a really good song.
Mostly recorded at a sound check on November 7th, 1995 at the Pyramid Arena in Memphis, Tennessee. This features touring keyboardist Scott McCaughey on piano, Mills on tuneful bass as well as organ and mellotron, and Buck playing very REM-ish arpeggiated guitar licks. This one has a throwback feel, something like Fall on Me in the verses, and then it goes monster loud in the choruses. You were saying this, JD. The vocals are classic Michael Stipe, too. His tone is quieter, nearly lazy sounding in the verses, and louder, more emotionally intense in the choruses. I read the lyrics as a man who has become unsatisfied with his static life. He's becoming bitter. He'd sooner chew his leg off than be trapped in this. It's gotten so bad that he doesn't even know what he wants anymore. I think most people have had those unhappy moments in their lives. You were describing that, JD, about this song, what it meant to you. Surprisingly, this was never played live in concert, even though it was the album's second single that reached number 6 on the Billboard Alternative Airplay chart. There's that chart again.
Whatever that is.
The following track is Be Mine.
I'll be the visions you will see. Visions you will see. You will see.
JD, what do you say?
So this is sort of a sister song to the song that was on Monster called Let Me In. It starts just single electric guitar with a vocal. The core, or the original at least, I don't know if they used any of it in this track or not, but the original recording of this was in the back of the tour bus, just guitar with Stipe on vocal. And there's a lot of, again, vocal imagery that's in here. So for me, this is building off the last song. So the Bittersweet Me is me kind of figuring out who I am. You know, maybe Stipe is calling some of that out as well. In my own personal world, I had made some bad decisions about, breaking up with my future wife and how I wanted to handle myself and the jobs that I had taken. And this is the reconciliation song. This is the, hold the boombox over your head song, calling back, trying to restore those relationships. There's an unheard of number of the word I in this song. So many times Stipe is like, I will, I'm gonna do this, I will, I'll ply, I'll pluck, I'll strip. There's so many things he promises to do in this song. And some of them are very visually important because they speak to like, I will basically do anything. But vocally, he paints a picture that's interesting. Like he says, I'll strip the world you must live in. I'll pull the thorns from your feet. I'll pull the tar from your feathers. I mean, these are very high, complicated things he's promising to do. And I think it's a visual of how far he's willing to go to make amends to whoever he's wronged, which spoke well in my world because, I wanted nothing more than to get back in the good graces of Lisa, who is my wife. And so like, I can just totally relate to this. At the end, there's different, instrumental, it gradually builds. You start with the single guitar, the bass comes in, there's some organ swells, you get some tambourine going. At 2:14, the full band kicks in for the first time, which is really powerful. At 2:29, you get a nice little Ebo solo. Then it backs all out again at 2:44. You start back with that solo guitar and it builds way up again. At 3:54, the full band kicks in. You get that You and Me repeated chorus. For me, this is sort of an anthem that if my wife at all liked this style of music, which she does not, so it's not worth my time. But if I could, like, I would put this on like one of those hypothetical mixtapes, for my wife, but she wouldn't like it, so I don't.
Lou.
There was a lot of this in 96, the sound. I don't know what they call it, a double. There's a little shine in there from Collective Soul. That's what I'm hearing in it. If you listen, I think I know why I have such a stink for these guys. And they're setting off my corporate rock detector. And the sellout meter is like up in the red. This song needs to be cut in half or add a few changes. It's or maybe something more than that one ascending riff with the turnaround at the end. Repeat, repeat, repeat. It's 4 minutes in. I'm bored to tears. Next.
It's the last track on the album recorded at Bad Animal Studio. This is mostly built around a strummed and distorted Peter Buck riff, with Mills adding guitar and keyboards and Barry providing a light touch on the drums and tambourine. Buck also plays the bass on this, and as the track progresses, he plays a memorable Ebo melody that blends with Mills' backing vocals and really brings the song home. This track is a Peter Buck showcase. Stipe's vocals are soft and tender, and on the surface, this comes across as a sweet love song. He wants to be your Easter bunny and Christmas tree. He wants the finger with the ring. But I can't shake the feeling that there's a darker underbelly to this, that it's an obsessive love. He chooses your sanctuary. He wants to become your religion. He wants to be the drawing of your breath and the cup when you bleed. I don't know if I trust you that much, Michael. Despite my misgivings about Stipe's intentions, this song is a highlight for me. I really like this. The next track is Binky the Doormat.
Distance is my tendency. Yeah.
How about this one?
There's another song that Peter Buck let his six-year-old play with the tone knobs on his amp before he went into play and record. Again, he's up in like Neil Young territory for uncomfortably too much distortion to serve the song. He's really standing his ground for having the worst fucking tone possible for this whole album. All the while, Michael Stipe is yammering on and on unintelligibly to himself. And then he screams something about wearing a doormat face, hanging tits and go away, go away. He's like that crazy dude in Manhattan that just starts talking to you about God knows what in the subway. And he thinks you know what the fuck he's talking about when you really know he's just crazy. And you need to get the fuck out of there before he stabs you with a prison shank. Get the fuck out of here.
JD.
I don't know where he comes up with half this stuff, but it's pretty funny. Anyways, so Being in the Doormat's the first song that where I come to go, if I were to cut some songs, because obviously we haven't talked about it, but these songs are long. Each individual song is long. Not to mention there's a lot of tracks on this record. It's over an hour. And this is the point of the record where some of them get a little samey sounding. We're going to dive into a little more monster bass for our sound. And there are some songs before this, specifically like Bittersweet Me and Be Mine. There's some songs coming later that I like better. If there was a song proper that I was going to cut, this would be one of them. If I were to stretch my little metaphor, I could think of this as being related to having kids. You know, when he talks about I'm defeated, have you lost your place, you know, being a doormat. But that's a stretch to be, you know, fair. The backing vocals are still pretty good. This is Mike Mills, does a great job with the backing vocals. All in all, if this were a B-side to one of the singles, it would be a great B-side. But I don't think it's needed on the record. The funny thing is of all these songs, while this is heralded as a road record and all these songs recorded on the road, the songs that are actually played live are very few on this tour anyway. Undertow was played a ton, and this song was probably the second most played actually live on that tour. But I just think it's one of the weaker actual songs on this record, just sounding samey to a lot of other ones that are better.
Binky the Doormat, mostly recorded on November 4th, 1995 at Desert Sky Pavilion in Phoenix, Arizona. This opens with Barry's thumping drums, Buck playing an arpeggiated figure, and December joining in with some guitar interplay, and Mills bringing the melodic fuzz bass. McCaughey adds a Farfisa organ line that's buried in the guitar noise, and Stipe sings in his lower register until the chorus, where he opens up. These lyrics are fucking dark, man. It takes two different points of view. A sexually abusive man and his woman who's become his submissive doormat. He subjects her to bondage with handcuffs, anal penetration with Astroglide lube, rough oral sex that leaves her with a sour milk mouth. She lays traumatized, gasping, tattered and torn. He sees nothing wrong with any of this. Can't she see he's loving her? While internally she screams, "Go away!" with Mills yelling out the "Go away!" vocals that cut through the music and ram home the point of this disturbing subject matter. Well, Stipe did warn us in the opening line that this is horror movie stuff. The following track is Zither. JD, you like this one?
Well, I guess you got to have to play with a new toy once in a while, but I don't think you need to put it on the record.
Lou.
This is by far my favorite song on the record.
Of course it is. Okay. Lou's playing this in his backyard at his margarita party.
Michael Stipe doesn't say a word.
He's credited as counting.
You think he came into the studio, put his cans on, shut the door, sat there and went, counted it off, gave a thumbs up and left. Now, why wouldn't Bill Berry count it in? You see, it's douchery like this that keeps me from accepting Michael Stipe as deserving of his rock star. But I love this song.
Oh, shit. Okay. I did not see that coming. Zither, mostly recorded in the dressing room of the Spectrum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in October 1995. It's a short instrumental the band must have just whipped up, featuring Berry on bass, Mills on organ, December on tambourine, Buck playing a wavering melody on the guitar that sounds like it could have come from an old West movie, and McCaughey strumming on the auto harp, a corded stringed instrument that's part of the Zither family that gives the track its name and includes the dulcimer, among other instruments. It's the shortest track on the album, but it's 2.5 minutes I don't really need, especially on a record that's over an hour long, like JD was referring to. This is
Aaron's Stinky Stinker.
And it's Lou's favorite.
That's great.
Of course it is.
The next track is So Fast, So Numb. You hate it.
So numb that you can't even feel. You're drinking raw, dream out, baby.
Lou, what do you say?
I say this could be every other REM song that they do. It's all blending together, just like it always did for me. There's nothing that hooks you, catches you, makes you want to sing it. It's like listening to a blow dryer for 4 minutes. Stipe has got one delivery. Buck has one tone. Both annoy me.
JD.
Well, so I disagree with Lou, but I understand his point. And this is what I was alluding to when we were at Binky the Doormat, because this is where a lot of these songs certainly sound pretty samey. I think this one does stand out, unlike Binky the Doormat with all its weird lyrics. I like this one better. This one I can tie more to my kids and make me feel like I ran into being a parent pretty fast. I have 5 kids. 4 of them are teenagers, and you know how that goes these days. I pretty much want to bang my head against a wall every single day. But at the time when I was having them, people were like, hey, you probably shouldn't do that so fast, so numb. So here we are. I like this tone. It's, you know, again, it's the monster riff noise, but it's subdued. It's controlled. The piano in this song under that progression is the best part to me. And I do like how it's got some of that 90s grunge alternative stop and start, loud and quiet. With, you know, when you get into the bridge, you got a nice distorted solo. Then at 2:30, you got just the acoustic guitar. At 3:07, it stops. You got the acoustic with some piano and some backing vocals. So this has enough dynamics for me to make it stand out that I would pass on some of the other samey-sounding songs. So while I like the song, it's certainly not a standout, but it's better than some of the other songs that probably should have been cut.
Mostly recorded on November 15th, 1995, at the Orlando Arena in Orlando, Florida. This one really doesn't make much of an impression on me. It's another rocker that does have some cool percussive piano pounding from McCaughey, and Buck actually plays a short whoop-de-doo guitar solo, but the main riff doesn't grab me, and I find the song, overall, forgettable. Stipe sings about a former lover who's been having difficulties, self-destructing, possibly substances are involved, and the narrator is watching in frustration as it's happening, trying to get the lover to see his point of view to no avail. I mean, hey, I could be wrong about that, but I really don't care. This tune just exists for me. The penultimate track is Low Desert.
I never
dust in the engine caps. Did your hands drip down off the wheel? Rode out, hit your windshield. An eyelash, show a little bit of sleep. Did time stand still? Just call it now and you're on your way.
JD, how about this one?
So again, on the same theme of all the samey-sounding songs, this one I think stands out a little bit uniquely with the groove and the bass fills. You get the little slap bass accent, which is unique. There's a couple different parts that rotate through. That for me, as I am a very rudimentary guitar player, is fun to play, which maybe is a compliment to the song, but probably also an indictment that it's simple enough that I could, play those different parts. It gives you this feeling of traveling, of moving through the world without an exact course. But again, you get this, there's nothing here. So the difference between this song and all of the other songs is I could pick out through all of Stipe's gibberish lyrics, there were always certain phrasings or certain verses or the chorus or whatever it may be that would stand out and speak to me. Like, I love what he says right here. This song does not have any of that. I mean, he says there's a radio tower that's egging him on. And while the flow of it is cool, it just, this song is completely gibberish and just speaks to, like, I'm out here and I'm doing my thing and I don't know really what the heck I'm doing and I'm tired. But it has one of the most complicated and introspective, awesome choruses that I've ever heard. And I quote, "Hey, hey, 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 hey." So that's good.
Introspective. Lou.
Is it his tuning? Is he out of tune, Peter Buck? Everything is really kind of ragged on this one. Like, you know, like all the acetates don't line up if you held them up to the light. It's, I can't put my finger on it, but I think it is that Peter's out of tune. It's probably because of the live thing that you were talking about, that they were recording these at sound checks and stuff. It's either that or his guitar needs to be intonated. Something's off. It almost sounds Pearl Jammy, which kind of makes sense. They traded singles in their fan clubs around this time too, I'm pretty sure. So, you know, each one was influencing on the other. That's all I got about this one. I don't hate it.
Mostly recorded in November 1995 at a sound check at the Omni Theater in Atlanta, Georgia. To me, this has a vague Southern rock flavor with December on slide guitar, Buck playing Southern fried licks, and Mills bringing in the fuzz bass and organ. Mills even slaps and pops a few bass notes. But Leonard Skinner, this is not. Barry supplements his drums with shaker percussion, and Stipe's vocals once again are rather subdued as he sings of a car crash on a desolate desert road, most likely somewhere in Nevada that the characters in the song seem to want to escape from, but the place they're heading back to is a place where they never belong, where the people thrive on their own contempt, as lost and empty as the desert itself. I don't know. This tune's okay, and it doesn't yank my crank. I could take it or leave it. And that brings us to the final track, Electrolyte.
20th century ghostly, your Pleistocene, that is obscene, that is obscene. You are the star tonight, sun electric out of sight, light eclipses the moon tonight, electrolyte.
How about this last one, Lou?
Well, this has a very different sound to it. It's more polished, still very live sounding, but it's more country kind of, and oddly enough, giving my aversion for country music. I think out of all the songs, here's the one that's kind of most listenable for me, if we're going to be serious. He's in a good register. He's not whining. And he's only minimally repetitive. I'd say, you know, if we're going to be serious, this is the best one on the record.
JD.
Yeah, so we open up with a Guiro solo, and it sets the mood for something weird. And it's interesting because the record opened with a kind of a weird song, and now we're closing with a weird song. It's piano-based with some acoustic behind it. You got some banjo in there over kind of a waltzy shuffle beat. It feels like you made it, like this is a celebration song. We got to the end of the tour. This was a tour that was filled with many medical issues, almost life-threatening stuff. It was long, and this song feels like the celebration at the end of it. You've got some, you know, Ebo in there. You've got some violin in there. There's a lot of instrumentation in there that gives it a ton of depth. And it's super poppy and happy, and it's celebratory. He talks about moving on from the 20th century. He says that he's not scared. And I love how, like, the whole record ends, this whole thing, this journey we've been on, whether it's my personal journey or anybody who can relate to their own personal journey through this record. At the end, he says, I'm not scared. I'm out of here. And that's how the record ends. It's a strange song to have as a single, because I think they did release it as a single, but it is one of the best songs on a record. It's great.
Electrolyte, mostly recorded on November 4th, 1995 at a sound check at the Desert Sky Pavilion in Phoenix, Arizona. This is based around a piano line written by Mills that's adorned with Buck on bass and banjo, December on Guiro, and a violin part and solo played by Andy Carlson that gives the track a kind of down-home, country, folky music feel that totally works. I read that lyrically Stipe is saying goodbye to the 20th century in the form of a trip along Mulholland Drive in California at night, looking down on the blanket of bright lights of Los Angeles, so bright they even eclipse the moon, thinking of Hollywood actors like James Dean, Steve McQueen, and Martin Sheen, and how L.A. is a town of dreams and fantasy and the collision of old guard ideals with the advancing modern age. Okay, Michael. This really is a cool little track right in the band's wheelhouse. It's a big fan favorite, and it was the third single that reached number 96 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. Now that the track by track is finished, we'll give our final thoughts and album ratings. For you new listeners, the rating is a 0 to 5 system, with 5 being a favorite album of ours, all the way down to a 0, which is worse off than Binky the Doormat. JD, what are your final thoughts on New Adventures in Hi-Fi?
So this record has some very highs, and, you know, the one biggest low is that it's very long. So if you want to sit down and listen to this thing end to end, you know, block a good hour. But for me personally, this tells a story of my life. There's all these different instances that I can tie back to these songs that I didn't know at the time. It's very retrospective. So when September 96 comes and I buy this record and I listen to it, you know, I liked the Rocky songs. I liked the songs that sounded like Monster. But then as I lived life, I would always go back to this record and go, wait a minute, that sounds like this. And when I would listen to it again and again, it would bring me back to those experiences and those emotions. I think it's unique for its time when, you know, nowadays everything is overproduced. You have all of this digital enhancement. And to have these songs played in a live environment where, yes, there are some overdubs and there's some vocal workings and stuff like that on there, but you really get the sense of this is a band at its peak playing together, which is my favorite sound of a band all in all. And the biggest thing is, you know, Lou, if you look back and think about it, not a single song fades. There's no major production weirdness to it. It's just a raw band with raw emotion playing through a story that is their story to tell, but for me personally, it relates to my own story. So it's one of my favorite records ever. It's a Desert Island record. I just wish there was a couple songs that they would cut out. I wish some of the songs maybe were slightly shorter. So overall, I give it a 4.5.
All right. Lou.
I get that you can tie back an album to different points in your life. And even when you first hear it, you just kind of know that this one's going to be with me a while. I've got albums like that too. Pearl Jam album Yield is one of them, actually. So I get it. Unfortunately, REM, there's not one REM album I can tie back to anything like that. So I'm glad that you can. And there are some artists that, even though I'll turn the radio off or walk out of a room that they're playing in, that I'll acknowledge their talent and understand why people are so gaga over them. But I can't with this guy, with these guys. I can't say it's the songwriting. The two chord vamps with the formulaic choruses that repeat until the end kind of gets old. And so does the whiny, sensitive guy thing. You're not good looking enough for that, Michael. And you definitely don't have the pipes to back it up. Peter Buck, he's got that Rickenbacker turned up as loud as it fucking goes, despite the song needing it that way or not, then the gain higher than that. But he can turn it up as loud and dirty as he wants. There's not one thing he played that made my head turn and say, whoa, what was that? Nothing on this record makes me reconsider listening to REM. But that said, there's an ass for every seat. But my butt crack don't line up with the REM chair's ass groove. And for me, it's an uncomfortable listen that I'm glad I don't have to go through again. I give it a 2, solely on no fade outs. And I just wasn't wowed once on this album, and not one thing stuck in my head. And I didn't look forward to hearing any of these tunes ever again. Sorry, but thanks.
On March 1st, 1995, during the tour supporting the album Monster, REM drummer Bill Berry collapsed on stage during a performance in Lausanne, Switzerland, due to a brain aneurysm. He had surgery immediately and recovered fully within a month. Feeling stronger and more bonded together coming out of this crisis, the band decided to compose songs on the road when the tour resumed, using an 8-track recorder to capture the bulk of the new songs live, with the 1973 Neil Young album Time Fades Away as inspiration. The band wanted the looseness and spontaneity of a soundcheck as a priority to the vibe, and the sound was a blend of the two previous REM albums, the acoustic country rock of Automatic for the People and the heavy distorted rock of Monster. After the Monster tour was completed, the group went into Bad Animal Studio in Seattle, Washington, and cut 4 additional tracks while finishing up the new tracks they recorded on tour. The album cover was a black and white photo of a blurry desert landscape as seen from a moving vehicle, and when New Adventures in Hi-Fi was released, it was favorably received by fans and critics, but over time it gained a growing cult status among fans as one of REM's best records and the last great one they ever recorded. It also was a particular favorite of Michael Stipe's. Unfortunately, this would be the last album recorded for the band by original drummer Bill Berry, who left REM amicably in October 1997, citing a lack of desire to travel and a lack of enjoyment to continue on with the group. The other 3 members would carry on as REM at the insistence of Berry. I like this album a lot. It's a return to the musical eclecticism that REM was known for, but is really dark thematically and lyrically, and reflects the traveling movement of the circumstances the record was created under. I'm in the camp of the fans who feel this is the last great REM album, and I have to believe that the departure of Bill Berry is the primary reason the band would never reach these heights again. There's something to be said about that intangible thing called band chemistry. And though the subsequent albums have their moments, it just wasn't the same. You need all 4 guys to really produce the magic. I even think that this record could have been better for me. If you take out the 4 tracks from Binky to Doormat to Low Desert Out and place Electrolyte after Be Mine, you'd have a tight 10-track album that would be among the band's very best. I would have given it a 4.5. As it is, however, those 4 tracks drag the album down a little for me, and I give New Adventures in Hi-Fi a 3.5. And with that, as Mr. Michael Stipe says at the end of Electrolyte, I'm out of here.
That's what it is, too. It's way too long. So by the time it gets to the end, I'm done, stick a fork in me. You should have put those songs earlier in the thing, cut out quite a few.
Yeah. Yeah, it was too much. Now we'd like to thank Jason Donsis for coming back to the podcast and talking some REM with us. I hope you had a good time, man.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. It was a good time.
Absolutely.
No hard feelings, JD.
I knew what I was getting into coming in. I'm not naive. I'm good. Listen, some of the best listens are, like, I'll see the title pop up, like, you know, villains from those types of mid-90s.
Oh, my. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm like, there's no way he likes this. I can't, and it makes me want to, like, I want to listen to those more. Like, there's no way. And it's too bad because Verve Pipe was a local band for, like, you know, when I was growing up in high school, they played all the time around here, and we're like, they're pretty solid as a local band. I remember seeing that pop up and like, I cannot wait to hear what he's got to say.
JD, is there anything you'd like to plug or promote or tell the listeners about?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, you know, if you're a big fan of music, make sure you're jumping on these podcasts, joining their Patreon. If you're a Black Crowes fan, State of America podcast is where you need to go. Join their Patreon. You can hear me on episode 68, which is Lay It All on Freed, where we combine the Freed era records to try to make a greatest record out of those two. Also, if you're into blues and Southern rock, jump into the All Things Blues and Southern Rock podcast hosted by Jason Bryan, good friends of mine. That's where you need to be. There's good new music out there. It may not seem like it, but if you know where to look, you'll find it.
Yeah, I enjoy those podcasts too. And JD, Jesus Christ, I forgot to acknowledge that you're one of our patrons. I'm sorry, dude. I thank you so much for that.
No worries.
Thank you so much for that. My shit, what an asshole I am. Yeah, absolutely. You're one of our patrons. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
The legendary patron.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's go.
This is a Patreon legend we've been talking to all this time. Damn. And that's going to do it for this episode. You can find this podcast on all the podcasting platforms wherever you listen to them. If you like what you hear, please subscribe or follow the podcast and leave us a review. If you'd like to contact us directly, we can be reached at ridiculousrockrecords@gmail.com or also on the Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews Facebook page, where there's a link to hear each podcast. We're also on Twitter at R4PodcastAaron and Instagram under R4Podcaster. If you feel the podcast has value and would like to make a contribution to support it, please head over to Patreon and the Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews page and sign up on one of the monthly tiers. Feel free to leave all of your feedback, comments, reviews, and or suggestions at any of those places I just described. We'd love to hear from you. So for the R4 Podcast, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Lou.
See ya.
Shut
that fucking car alarm off!
'Kay, I felt my mouth got all like watery really bad. I'm not speaking right. My mouth isn't doing what I want it to do. I rather have that. I hate that. Okay.
All the time.
Yeah. I'm talking and my mouth is filling with spit as I'm talking, so I'm trying to sound like I'm drowning while I'm talking. It's terrible.
Yeah, that's a couple songs away.
Oh, I hate that.